Thanks for tuning in to this month's edition of Fire on the Prairie, the radio show brought to you by In These Times magazine. I'm Emily Udell.
And I'm Aaron Sarver. On this show, Dr. Cornell West.
Black folks in America, look at yourself in the mirror closely. What kind of nation are you really? Take off your mask. Hold at arm's length the lies. Penetrate deeply into your night side.
Hear an excerpt from a recent lecture the Princeton University professor and author gave at the University of Chicago.
Also on this episode, hear a conversation with hip-hop historian Jeff Chang, author of the award-winning book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation.
You're listening to Fire on the Prairie.
Hip-hop originated in the Bronx in New York. DJ Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa were just two of the myriad hip-hop pioneers to come up in this tiny geographic space during the 1970s. This is where Jeff Chang begins his book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop. Part history, part sociology, Chang's book traces hip-hop from the Bronx to its rise as a global youth culture by the end of the 90s. Chang's writing as a hip-hop journalist has been honed in the pages of The Nation, Mother Jones, and The Village Voice for more than a decade. Aaron Sarver sat down with Jeff Chang in the offices of In These Times to talk about his experiences with hip-hop and Can't Stop, Won't Stop, which won the American Book Award in 2005.
Besides your personal interest in hip-hop, why else did you want to write a history of hip-hop?
You know, a lot of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, Point Blank came from these very fraught, torturous, frustrating conversations I had with elders about our generation and defending our generation. All of the standard stuff that folks in the generation after the baby boomers always heard, like, you guys aren't as political as we were, you're not as in the streets as we were. The sort of hip-hop generation always has been framed as something post. We're always the after effect, and inevitably we're a decline, something less than what happened before. The process of trying to put together an answer for all of these accusations, a lot meant as constructive criticism, and a lot meant just in a real malicious, you know, you guys ain't type of way, was where the seeds came for Can't Stop, Won't Stop. To see all of this stuff kind of coming together, I realized that now there was a 30-year narrative that could be written about all of this, going back to 68, which is sort of the marker, the key turning point in the baby boomer generation / civil rights generation.
Did you learn anything that surprised you while you were working on the book?
Every day it was sort of like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that, you know. I had what I thought was a pretty good general idea of what the roots were of hip-hop, but I think especially in the early part of beginning to write the book, in about 2001, going into 2002, when I was still living in New York and spending a lot of time with a lot of different pioneers at the time, every single day I was just stunned and amazed to learn about different kinds of connections that would occur. For instance, meeting Benjamin Melendez, who was one of the founders of the Ghetto Brothers gang, whose pioneering efforts around the Gang Peace Treaty in 1971 then leads to the emergence of hip-hop in the Bronx. Finding out that he and his family had been basically evicted. They were living on 14th Street. So during the period in which Robert Moses was going in and condemning large portions of Lower Manhattan so that he could create this Lower Manhattan Expressway and start encouraging the building of high-rises in these sort of ghetto areas, that's when Benjamin Melendez moves up to the Bronx. And then they move right up to the area in which the Cross Bronx Expressway had decimated these neighborhoods. And the first gang that he's in is called the Kofan Cats, which is a group that Kool Herc ends up joining later on, but is literally a half a block away from this most contested mile where the women of the Bronx, of the Tremont area, had gotten together and tried to fight Moses from running the highway through that neighborhood and had lost. And that's where the gang ends up starting. All of these different types of strange connections between what I was reading in books and what I was hearing from people in the street and what I was seeing with my own eyes, you know, the effects of all of this stuff many, many years later, just blew my head. Having not grown up in New York City, to be able to see then people walking through this landscape that's described by Robert Caro, or understanding the actual physical impact that it was having on people, and then seeing what occurred out of it, that there was a direct connection, domino effect, all the way to the rise of hip-hop. I would come home at night and just be awake all night because my head would be spinning with all of these different types of things that were going on.
What was it like to hang out with DJ Herc and other folks like that?
DJ Kool Herc was always presented as kind of a mystery, and that was probably in large part due to his own making. For a lot of good reasons, has always been very sort of standoffish from people that want to come in and present his story. A lot of the hip-hop pioneers are very much wary of outsiders, of being exploited. They've been exploited for so long that they're very protective of each other and themselves and their own legacy. So what that's created from a standpoint of historiography, the standpoint of journalism, the standpoint of the story being told, is there's a group of folks that really hold the history of the entire community in their hands. I was very fortunate to be given access, some access, to some of those circles and some of those stories with the unspoken proviso at every turn that you're going to have to go in and do this right. For me, writing the book and then even having the book out was always a very fragile process because I was always worried about how they would take what had been written down. It's a process that at every turn reminded me that the story that you're going to tell is just your way of looking at it, filtered through what you've learned from all of these folks. I still kind of carry that. I still am worried about how it gets read. And to me, the best thing that could come out of this is more folks will come forward and say, well, no, it wasn't that way. It was this way. To me, that would be the best thing. It wouldn't undermine the text at all.
Hip-hop was a very local phenomenon at its inception. What role did the social and political conditions in the early 70s Bronx have to do with the creation of hip-hop?
Really, what I try to lay out is an argument that the Bronx represented the result of the politics of abandonment. What happened was, by the time the 70s rolled around, the Lords and the Panthers were all gone, and the gangs had pretty much taken over. This is a cycle that begins to take place in cities all around the country, you know, moving from the 60s into the 70s. And out of it, there usually is very urgent peace work that begins to occur. When that occurs, then there's usually a sort of creative explosion that then follows that. And the Bronx was particularly unique in this sense because the gang peace treaty was so all-encompassing. So it literally transformed everything when the treaty goes through. And it's not that the treaty held, because it didn't really hold in a major way. Pretty soon, a lot of the leaders were run off into jail, and the gang warfare continued under different leadership. But by that time, you begin to see the rise of a new generation of young folks that aren't as scared to come out and party and celebrate in the open. And so the very particular kind of culture that you saw in the Bronx, it's happening everywhere. It's happening in Oakland. It's happening in Philadelphia. It's happening in Los Angeles. The way that this sort of global capitalist restructuring that occurs during the 70s actually then opens up all of these spaces for young people to insert themselves, really autonomous spaces, to insert themselves and then to sort of create these subcultures that then become huge out of that. There are all kinds of very unique street cultures with a unique form of dance, a unique form of music to that area, and all of these different types of things that are kind of going on, this sort of really amazing cultural flux that's happening during the early 70s. But the Bronx, because it's literally a few train stops from the media capital of the world, the neighborhood culture that took root in the Bronx then became the street culture of the world in, you know, a decade after that.
Hip-hop has also fueled a lot of cultural backlash. Ice-T's Cop Killer, and you talk about the Death Certificate album in the book. What effect has this backlash, even from the black community at times, had on hip-hop?
If you kind of look at Can't Stop, Won't Stop, the beginning of the book, maybe the first half of the book, there's a lot of discussion of race in America. And I think what happens is there's sort of a shift right around that time that you're describing, you know, 1990 to 1992 or 3. There's a very important shift that occurs where it's not just about race anymore, but now it's about race and generation. And it has to do also with the rise of the politics of containment. If we begin the story with the politics of abandonment, with the Bronx being abandoned, half the whites leaving, you know, most of the jobs leaving, and then government pulling money out, what we arrive at in the 80s and the 90s is the emergence of a new apparatus that's about taking all of these young people that have been surplused and now trying to round them up and contain them and pull them out of, you know, society proper. It begins with things as dumb as anti-breakdancing ordinances, and it explodes into anti-lording ordinances, gang databases, and the entire culture war, which, even as it's enacted in Congress, you know, the culture war as enacted in Congress, presents the picture of a civil rights generation activist named C. Dolores Tucker, an African-American woman, sitting in front of a subcommittee chaired by Carol Moseley Braun, a Chicago black liberal woman, discussing how to censor the culture of their children. It's not merely about race anymore. Now it's about race and generation, and it's about containment. It's about containment of the bodies, and it's about containment of the ideas. You know, we had the National Hip Hop Political Convention in 2004, and it was modeled quite consciously on the 1972 National Black Political Assembly. And the idea was, on the first day, we, the hip-hop generation, were going to bring in folks from the civil rights generation, and we were going to have an intergenerational dialogue. Well, that day ended up in a lot of shouting and cursing, a lot of people walking out. It was the first time in a long time that people had had an opportunity to actually get at the heart of these issues, and we couldn't really get past the yelling and the screaming. And I think that we're still at that point on a lot of these issues. I think there's still a lot of misunderstanding of hip-hop and the hip-hop generation.
Okay, well, thanks for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
That was an interview with Jeff Chang, author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. To find out more about Jeff Chang and read his blog, visit can'tstopwon'tstop.com. You're listening to Fire on the Prairie.
Dr. Cornel West is a scholar, public intellectual, and author of numerous books. His most recent, Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism, came out in paperback last year. He contributed to the new book, The Covenant with Black America, edited by radio and TV talk show host Tavis Smiley. The two have been traveling to publicize the book, which is intended to galvanize people towards a new movement for social change. Dr. West teaches in the Department of Religion at Princeton University. The following is an excerpt from a talk sponsored by the University of Chicago's Organization of Black Students as part of their George E. Kent Lecture Series.
But I want to begin with the line from Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay, Experience, of 1844. He raised the question, where do we find ourselves? Where do we find ourselves? And because this is a lectureship that is grounded in the doings and sufferings of people of African descent in the New World, and those doings and sufferings constitute a springboard that connects black people with other folk in this country and around the world, I want to begin this particular moment where I find myself. I don't know about you, but I find myself in deep mourning. I have a heavy heart. I have yet to get over the death of Luther Vandross. He meant so much to me. Then there's the freest black man that ever set foot in America, Richard Pryor. Gone. Lou Rawls. Gone. Wilson Pickett. Gone. Eugene Record, the Shylights. Means much to me. Gone. Deep sense of loss. Lament. Rosa Parks, towering figure, gone. And then Coretta Scott King. One can go on and on. You understand what I'm talking about. We are in a moment of profound transition. It's partly generational, partly ideological, it's partly institutional. We're in a new space, on a new terrain, and it's hard to find one's footing when those kind of towering figures pass away. How do you memorialize loss? How do you ensure that the legacy that these particular peoples enacted at such a high level of arte excellence, I love that, keep excellence alive along with the hope. The Greeks had no conception of hope as a virtue, did they? The more Christians need a conception of excellence as a virtue. No doubt. But how do you keep legacies alive? Well, I want to turn to Du Bois's text in 1924. It's a text that's rarely read. I'm sure most of you have read and reread The Souls of Black Folk that he published in 1903 at the age of 35 years old. But 21 years later, he published a text called The Gift of Black Folk. Been out of print for a long time. We need to reissue the text. It's one of the reasons why you look at the covenant curriculum, we begin with an epigraph from that text. What have been the gift of black folk? Not just the black people, not just the white people, to the nation and the whole world. I want to highlight three fundamental gifts that have everything to do with deep sense of loss. The first gift is black people's distinctive form of Socratic questioning. A distinctive form of Socratic questioning. Now, of course, no accident that Plato himself writes his dialogue with a deep sense of loss. Socrates is dead. How do you preserve his legacy? How do you ensure that your mourning over his death does not block your intellectual creative work? How do you ensure, in fact, that the world never, ever forgets your mentor? Plato did a pretty good job, didn't he? Still talking about that Athenian named Socrates. And black folk have always had an intimate connection with line 38a of Plato's Apology. The unexamined life is not worth living. Malcolm X adds, the examined life is painful. And when it comes to America, how difficult it is to engage in Socratic questioning that unsettles and unnerves and unhouses us in relation to particular kind of dogma that for so long the country wanted to hold on to for dear life. Dogmas like white supremacy. End up writing a magnificent constitution, but we the people are so circumscribed that it ends up being a pro-slavery document. With all the wonderful democratic juices flowing out of it, but circumscribed by a dogma that even the founding fathers and all of their grand vision didn't really want to Socratically question. And if it were not for the determination of the slave to be free, that document would have remained for many decades longer with all of its grand democratic energies, a pro-slavery document. The Greek actually says, the unexamined life is not a life for the human. And this is so very important, the human. Why does this line mean so much to black people? Well, because in fact, black people's humanity has been so radically called into question for so long, because white supremacy is in part a form of institutionalized hatred of black people. It's a form of organized contempt against black people, trying to convince black people they're less human, less beautiful, less moral, less intelligent, and therefore the question of how do I come to terms with my humanity when it's under attack all the time sits at the center of who you are.
You're listening to an excerpt of a recent lecture given by Cornel West. This is Fire on the Prairie. Visit us on the web at fireontheprairie.com.
Now, Vico tells us in his text, The New Science of 1725, in the 12th paragraph, that our English word human derives from the Latin humando. And humando means what? Burying. Burying. Antigone got it right. I'm going to invest my whole self in the honor of burying my brother so that, in fact, his humanity is not thoroughly lost in Sophocles' towering and timeless classic. Burying, what does it really mean to be featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creatures born between urine and feces? That's us, who often bury our dead to impose a certain structure of meaning and feeling upon the dead that connects the quick with the dead, that brings together the three dimensions of time, past, present, and future. Maybe we are most human when we stand before the coffin of our loved ones and have to wrestle with shudder and shiver, kind of an existential tremor of who am I, what am I here for? That's a frightening question. Well, see, black folk continually have been raising these deep Socratic questions to America and the world. What does it really mean to be human? And that's a difficult thing to do in a market-driven society obsessed with buying and selling and making and mending, people obsessed with careers. We don't have time for deep existential Socratic questions. No, no. Black folks in America, look at yourself in the mirror closely. What kind of nation are you really? Take off your mask. Hold at arm's length the lies. Penetrate deeply into your night side. Have you looked at your reservations? Have you looked at your chocolate cities? Have you looked at your dilapidated educational systems? Have you looked at your unavailable health care and child care? Have you looked at the underemployment and unemployment in working class communities across race? Have you looked at the night side of your foreign policy in Latin America and the Middle East and Africa and Asia? Are you willing to be Socratic, or do you just want to remain Peter Pan-like, full of innocence, feeling as if somehow a sentimental tale in which you end up being the victor fundamentally defines who you are? No accident that the black presence in America makes people uneasy. Socrates did too. In fact, Socrates says in that same dialogue, line 24a, parrhasia is the cause of my unpopularity. Frank speech, bold speech, honest speech, plain speech was the cause of my unpopularity, Socrates says. Why? Because David Walker, 1829, Peel, plain speech, dead in 13 months in a hotel in Boston. What did he have to say? Mr. Jefferson, you are a great white man. I don't understand why you are tied to the dogma of white supremacy. I need to out-democratize your democratic project. Dead. We can go right down the line. Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Ida B. Wells Barnett, A. Philip Randolph, Marcus Garvey, Diane Nash, Ella Baker. We can go on and on. Bold speech, not in a spirit of self-righteousness, just being willing to stand and speak certain truths that cut radically against the grain. That's Socratic. It's profoundly Socratic. And it has everything to do with what the Greeks used to call paideia. that formation of attention that tries to convince us to shift from the frivolous to the serious, from the superficial to the substantial, to really want to cultivate oneself in such a way that against the wounds and scars and bruises of one's own mind, body, and soul, you still want to grow and develop, so that a maturation of a soul that wrestles with the underside of reality and the underside of history, confronts mortality, talks explicitly and openly about death. You can always tell a Socratic figure, because he or she, always willing to talk about death and many times put it at the very center of the dialogue. The very center of the dialogue. Just rereading, actually, the other day, the wonderful lectures that Leo Strauss gave on the problem of Socrates here in 1958. It's powerful stuff. One of the high moments of Brother Leo Strauss. I don't have too much to say about his disciples, but he's got something to say. Wrestling with the challenge of Aristophanic comedy, but wrestling with how to live, which is inseparable from how one learns how to die. To philosophize is to learn how to die. Philosophy itself is a meditation on preparation for death, Socrates says. Seneca says, he or she who learns how to die unlearns slavery. Let me say that again. We don't expect that kind of depth from the Romans. Seneca says, he or she who learns how to die unlearns slavery. Well, what is it about black folk connected to death talk? Well, there's 52,400 slave ships between 1440 and 1888. The last one went to Brazil. Over 400 and some years, every slave ship had African bodies on it. Possibility of physical death. Millions didn't make it. Just wasted cargo. When they arrived in the New World from Brazil to the States, social death awaiting them. That's what New World slavery was, the threat of social death. They having no public value whatsoever, no social status whatsoever, just commodities to be bought and sold. And if you can't come to terms with sudden physical death and institutionalized social death, there wouldn't be black folk in this audience right now. That's what foremothers and forefathers did. The very fact that there's still some Negroes or post-Negroes around is a major achievement. Just the very fact that they're walking around.
That was an excerpt of a talk given by Cornel West at the University of Chicago. The lecture was part of a series sponsored by the university's Organization of Black Students. Thanks to the organization's political chair, Aaron Cobbs, for allowing us to record the event.
Thanks so much for listening to this month's edition of Fire on the Prairie.
Visit us online at fireontheprairie.com. If you enjoyed this show's excerpt of Cornel West, you can download our archived episode from March 2005 to hear more great audio with Dr. West.
You can also download past shows with such provocative guests as Barbara Ehrenreich, Gore Vidal, Rashid Khalidi, and many more. Again, that's at fireontheprairie.com.
This show was produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago. Fire on the Prairie is sponsored by In These Times magazine. Visit In These Times on the web at inthesetimes.com and join us again next month for Fire on the Prairie.